Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook.
It's Wednesday, May 8th from HPR2. It's The Conversation. The war to end all wars, war memorial, war continues.
He's dealt with how Celts felt.
New state runways for Hawaii, not airports. Think Vogue, Vogue, Vogue.
And all that Big Island jazz and blues.
Plus today's international report from Deutsche Welle, a backyard Prussian, and the reality check too.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Walk carefully in Waikiki and carry a big stick. You'll need it to draw your line in the sand to keep or reclaim the natatorium. The four-decades-old fight still continues. Despite last week's show of solidarity with certain community groups, Governor Abercrombie and Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell. Will the war memorial turn back to the beach? The mayor hopes so, and he's on the phone with us this morning. Good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Hey, good morning, Bethan. It's good to talk to you this morning. Just got back from selling newspapers for PAC this morning, and what a beautiful day out there and a lot of generosity shown by the community. And now we're on the radio with you talking about a very important issue in Waikiki, the natatorium.
Just another busy day.
Yes.
But let's talk about this natatorium issue, because it's not one that we haven't been talking about for, 45 years or so?
Yeah,
that's most of your life
now.
Since you were a little boy.
Yeah, you too.
Well, talking about this, how then do we try to move this into some level of reconciliation or compromise or just conclusion?
I think conclusion is the most important thing here. You know, this proposal that we're talking about, tearing down the pool, moving the arches, preserving the iconic arches and the memorial itself, is what came out of a task force that worked for almost a year back in 2009 and 10. And this task force is comprised of residents of Waikiki, veterans groups, and others, preservationists. And they took a vote, and the overwhelming majority of the people voted the best solution for the natatorium was to remove the pool, reestablish a beach, and celebrate the best thing about Waikiki, which is this open beach-like area, and preserve the memorial and the arches near the stone plaque that honors those who gave their ultimate sacrifice in World War One. That's what we're doing.
In some ways, this is really tearing a heart between the realities of cost to either restore it in some way, or to say, okay, we're going to leave the best part of it, which is the memorial itself, obviously relocated a little bit, and have respect for the monument. But getting caught in between that, there are groups of people who say they don't feel that they were really part of the process. Stanley Chang says, well, let's ask the constituents to weigh in, which is, in fact, sort of what they've kind of already done.
Right.
It seems as if there is always this movement to see if we do it one more time, maybe we'll find a way to make everybody happy. Is that really possible?
I don't think so. You know, one thing, Bethann, you know, the saltwater swimming pools were the rage back in the 1920s and 30s, and you could find them up and down the west coast of the United States and some on the east coast, too. And, of course, we had our natatorium here in Waikiki. But you look around this country, and most saltwater pools have gone by the wayside. The main reason is the health standards set today are so extreme that it is very expensive. So to rebuild the pool and maintain it properly, it's almost a $70 million undertaking versus demolishing the pool and putting in a beach is about $18.4 million. And, you know, I think we're doing something that the community wants to see done. At this point, we've shown great disrespect, as Governor Abercrombie said, by allowing the pool to decay over the past four decades. And to continue to debate and talk about what else we should do, and let's give it more time to raise money. We've had a lot of time for people to raise money to address doing something else with the pool. Not $1 has been raised. And I believe that this is something that's affordable, that the taxpayers of the city and county of Honolulu and the state of Hawaii are willing to pay. And think about this. Once it's done, when you stand on Waikiki Beach down by the Sheraton or the Royal and look towards Diamond Head, that iconic image that everyone around the world identifies with Hawaii, you no longer see a bunch of white bleachers blocking out the trees behind it. You'll see a beautiful beach with arches that you will actually get to see with eagles on the top. And people will know that's the memorial to those in World War I who gave their ultimate sacrifice for their country.
All that sounds perfectly lovely, unless you're talking to people who are friends of the Natatorium or Kapi'olani Park Preservation Society. Is there any way of being able to bring them into the fold, if not make them happy, but somehow to do something that would create some sort of compromise with them? Or is that really going to be simply out of the question because this has gone on for so long now that cost is just going to be the defining line?
Well, I think first, the Kapi'olani Trust, my understanding could be wrong, but I think one of their board members was at the press conference and spoke very eloquently about the plan. And so I'm not certain that the trust is opposed to restoring a beach in that area. They are concerned about building facilities in trust land, but I'm not certain that they're opposed. The Friends of the Natatorium are opposed. They have been opposed. The task force was comprised of community input, the very input that they want to have more of. And at the end of the day, I think just like anything in life, Bethann, when decisions are made, not everyone will be in agreement. But as long as it was open, there was discussion and input, we need to move forward. Otherwise, what can happen here is we can stall out a decision, spend another 30 or 40 years talking about whether everyone's concerns have been addressed. And at some point, the pool is going to crumble into the sea. It's on the verge. It has collapsed in areas. And that's the ultimate disrespect. And so I think this is a decision we can afford. It's a decision that is supported by the task force, as I mentioned, comprised by a lot of different stakeholders in the community. And I think while some people disagree, I'm hopeful that we'll be able to move forward finally after 40 years and restore a beach that everyone can use. I mean, beaches around this island are eroding. There's very few beaches that people who live in the community go to. In Waikiki, Kaumana Beach is one of those. And this additional beach, I think, will be an expansion of Kaumana Beach and will allow people to come down and enjoy themselves in Waikiki with their families. Coming from the Ahupua of Manoa, Makaukau, Makiki, Nu'uanu,
Mr. Mayor, though, Hololo. Do you think it's possible that we're going to actually see some conclusion to all this when you've got groups still threatening lawsuits that will perhaps protract this even further into the future to where the solution simply becomes the pool does crumble into the sea, although you may be saying enough already, they may be saying and certainly are not enough.
Yeah. You know, as when I was in private practice for 30 years, I tell clients that people can always file lawsuits if we follow the procedure appropriately, and the most important thing is doing a thorough, complete EIS, which will address many of the concerns that are being raised by those opposed to the Natatorium being removed. And then we proceed expeditiously and openly through the fund, you know, getting funds from the state and county government. I believe we can move forward as mayor and working with the governor. We're going to work really hard to do exactly that.
All right.
To finally come up with a solution and make a difference in this part of Waikiki once and for all.
Well, I just
hope
that
want to challenge will be open to hear what they have to say.
I hope that we're all alive so we can see that solution. I'm sorry, Mr. Mayor, we've got to go, but thanks
much
for your time this morning. I know you have to go, too. Thanks.
Yes. Thank you, Bethann.
Aloha.
Okay, aloha.
Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell was born in Waipahu, raised in Hilo, and before leaving Hawaii to study urban planning and economics at Tufts University, he came home to attend the UH Law School, was managing partner at Ashford and Wriston, and since 2002... has been in public service. How to serve a public divided over the future of the Natatorium has been the issue no mayor has been able to answer, though, in 45 years. This is the conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. Later in the show, honoring pagan traditions on Maui and stalking STEM strength in the reality check. But first, a royal treasure.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're celebrating one of our local treasures, the Royal Hawaiian Band. After 175 years, there's still nothing else like it. Created by a king, Kamehameha III, it's the only full-time municipal band in the United States. The band is actually an agency of the city and county of Honolulu, and its members are city employees. According to its website, the band's mission is to promote and foster music, both current and historic, to preserve the Hawaiian musical culture, inspire young musicians, and ultimately enrich the lives of the people and visitors of Hawaii. Now, if you've heard the band, you may have noticed that some of the music, including the state anthem, Hawaii Pono'i, has a distinctly Germanic lilt, and there's a reason. An influential bandmaster from the band's early days came to Hawaii on loan from the Prussian government. He brought some of that Prussian discipline to the band and even composed Hawaii Pono'i, a song that was originally known as the Hymn of Kamehameha I. His work is reflected in the band's sound to this day, and this morning we're looking for his name. We'll pick up the baton and the story in the next half hour.
Hi, good morning. I'm Andy Morishita from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Hamish Burgess is devoted to the culture of his ancestors, the arts of the Celtic people rooted in paganism, worship of the sun, and ancient mysticism. The pictorial side of Hamish's work is filled with a distinctive color palette and images that take us to the origin of the cultures of the British Isles. The Celtic art of Hamish Burgess will be on display on Maui this month, and Hamish joins us by phone. Good morning, Hamish.
Morning, Chris. How are you doing?
All right. Good to talk to you. You know, your images really evoke a fascinating time that I don't think people know very much about.
Right, and it also the high point of it was also when the Celtic Christian monks came along. So it did span the pagan and the Christian eras as well.
This is kind of the transition, right? The birth of Christianity in the British Isles. Is that accurate?
Absolutely, and across a lot of Europe as well, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And it started. Celtic art probably started about 2,500 years ago in what is now Switzerland, Austria, and southern Germany.
Really?
And the Celtic tribes spread out through the entire of Europe. And definitely a tribal people. There was no nations. It was there was a few confederations of tribes, but they spread from those homelands. In the east, they went as far as Turkey, which was called Galatia at the time, and one of the books, I guess, in the Bible is somebody's letter to the Galatians, right?
Yeah.
And but then they also spread as far west as the British Isles and Ireland.
So they were sort of nomadic by nature.
Yeah, reasonably nomadic, and you know, they would settle in areas and generally stay in those areas. But when the Roman Empire expanded their territory, a lot of these people were pushed into other areas and emigrated to other areas, and they ended up being pushed to the far west, and the Celtic lands that kind of remain Celtic and stayed that way to this day, they'd be the most common one everybody thinks of is Ireland and Scotland, but there's also the Isle of Man, there's Wales, Cornwall, and Brittany in the northwest of France.
So this is the kind of the farthest reach of the Roman push, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's as far as they could get.
The end of the earth as far as the Romans were concerned.
Yeah. And, you know, you can't really overstate the effect of the Roman Empire on moving cultures around in those years, those B.C. years, yeah?
Absolutely. And they didn't necessarily go out to destroy a lot of those cultures. They absorbed them into the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
So a lot of those areas became, Romano-British. They would call it Romano-Celtic. One area that a lot of people forget is Galicia and the Asturias in the north of Spain is also Celtic.
I'd forgotten that. Well, that's kind of a remark, you know, so there's a lot more to this world than most people, because people think of Celtic culture as Ireland and Scotland for the most
absolutely,
part.
Absolutely,
right?
Yeah. They normally restrict it to that in everybody's thinking, but it's quite a lot more than that.
Now, that's you're obviously a student of that, and this obviously comes from your ancestry. Has it always been part of your life?
No, some of my youthful years were spent riding British motorbikes and partying quite a lot and listening to rock and roll, but...
No harm there.
But actually, when I came to the Americas, I immigrated about 20-something years ago, and when I came to the Americas, people's enthusiasm here for their ancestry actually rubs off on you a little bit.
Sure,
and
sure.
And it made me look at my own ancestry a little bit more, and... I started getting into my Scottish culture, and then I kind of broadened out into general Celtic culture. And I'd been looking at Celtic art since I was young, even though I wasn't really doing much about it. I was poring over these books of my childhood artist heroes.
Yeah.
You know, there's a handful of great Celtic artists in the world who I actually, in later years, happened to be friends with, which is kind of nice.
It is.
But, you know, we'd pour over these books, me and my brother, who's also a great Celtic artist. He's in Cornwall in the UK these days.
Uh-huh.
And wasn't really till I came to Maui. I was in Honolulu for a couple of years, and I came to Maui about 15 years ago. And one of the first things I did was I painted a blue station wagon. I painted it black with Celtic knotwork all over it.
Oh, boy.
And it became quite a well-known local feature in Lahaina.
I can only imagine.
And that's when I really started producing some Celtic art. But, you know, I was still trying to pay the bills. I was working as a scuba diver instructor and a bit of construction here and there and whatever you needed to do. But
yeah, that's a pretty rich... Sounds like a pretty rich life, Hamish.
No, I've had a fabulous life. A lot of travel. I've been traveling for a very long time. But Hawaii is definitely home for the last 17 years.
Well, when I first looked at your work, I had an immediate sort of flash of recognition based on really the color palette, the golds and the reds. There's something distinctive about the colors, at least to my imagination, that I identified with past Celtic art that I had seen.
Right.
And the images almost look like a little bit related to the kind of images you might associate with heraldry, where you have the way the images are arrayed. It almost looks like a coat of arms, one of the images that I'm looking at.
Yeah.
Is there a link to that kind of art?
Not really. No, the coats of arms and the clans probably developed a little bit later than the high period of Celtic art.
What was the high period, Hamish?
The high period, there's two phases, if I can steer off just a little bit. The very earliest one was called Latin. I was aware of that word for many years, and last summer, I went to look at that, and Latin is actually a culture in what is now Neuchâtel in Switzerland. And there was a lakeside Celtic culture, and they had this very curly, swervy, ancient type of Celtic art. And that crossed all over Europe, and it's still on standing stones in the British Isles and Ireland.
Well, so Hamish, you will see evidence of this in places that you wouldn't have expected. Could you go back to Switzerland and see signs of that today?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Hamish, I'm afraid we've eaten up our time.
Okay,
it's great to talk to you. And,
all right, the monks were the high point of Celtic art in their Gospels in the 800s AD.
So that's kind of the main source of your inspiration.
Yeah.
The work is fascinating to look at, and I appreciate your taking the time, Hamish. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Hamish Burgess is a Maui-based artist and musician. His art show, The Celtic Art of Hamish Burgess, will be on display during the month of May at Hawaiian Village Coffee in the Kahana Gateway Center, and you can learn more at our HPR website.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bush Consulting, providing IT support, customized network services, and backup recovery for Hawaii's businesses since 1990. Learn more about outsourced IT at buschconsulting.com.
Actual votes in South Carolina, polls surprise in Massachusetts. The Heritage Foundation's big number on the cost of immigration reform draws fire from both sides of the aisle, and everyone wants to know about Chris Christie's lap band. I'm Neil Conan. Political junkie Ken Rudin's back with all that, plus a trivia question, of course. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after The Conversation.
HBR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Janet Burke of Kihei, Ken Buchanan of Keaau, and Linda Kim of Kaneohe for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure in knowing you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:27. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. Is Hawaii doing enough to engage kids early on and throughout their school years in science, technology, engineering, and math? Many STEM advocates say no. CivilBeat.com reporter Chad Blair found out why in today's Reality Check. Hi, Chad.
Hello, Beth Ann.
Okay, so how can these critics of what we are or aren't doing with STEM education actually have a basis if, for example, with the race to the top, we're required to be STEM compliant?
That's right. $75 million from the federal government for Hawaii to have the DOE have more STEM instruction. But we are not quite there yet, far from it, actually. Let me give you a statistic that kind of illustrates how important it is to get our students educated on science, technology, engineering, and math, STEM. 92% of the 3,000 STEM-related jobs in Hawaii went to mainland hires.
That stings.
That's pretty shocking. We would love to see our own get those jobs and stay here in the islands rather than having to find work on the mainland. But critics say we're just not moving fast and far enough on STEM-related programs in our schools.
Which is, in a way, ironic because, you know, all of it, science, technology, engineering, math, moving so quickly. And yet the sting of knowing that 92% of all those positions that were, you know, in some way STEM-related went to mainland hires doesn't also seem to be an impetus for us to be moving any faster. Why?
Well, these are good questions. And in defense of the DOE, they do have some initiatives that have been moving along. You've heard a lot about the robotics programs. We're doing pretty good in that regard. Farm-to-school programs. There's some mobile science labs. The problem is it's just too isolated. It's not something that is widespread throughout. You know, STEM is not just as important here in Hawaii. It really is a national effort. The President Obama has $1 billion in his latest budget focused on STEM education. So these are things that we need to work on here in the islands.
Some schools, though, are doing a better job of it. In particular, the charter schools seem to be able to focus it more narrowly. There's a new charter school, CQ's, that looks at a lot of those essential questions and sort of has this interdisciplinary approach throughout its curriculum to be able to bring in these issues and not just isolate them as, well, this is science or this is math, but really this is life.
Yes, and you asked why we're not doing better. Really, it comes down to resources, financial support. By the way, I should point out, it's not just about getting, you know, high-quality math and science courses. It's really about training kids to turn their observations into scientific inquiry, to look about the world, to ask questions. You know, one of the criticisms of K-12 education, too focused on testing, too focused on one-size-fits-all instruction. STEM research, STEM programs are designed to stimulate curiosity and interest and intellectual growth.
Which is what some of the Steiner and Waldorf schools have been saying since
That's the last part of last century.
The early part of last century. Thanks, Chad. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Sure, Beth, and look forward to it.
Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com. This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. I've got Bert on the line and can talk about the Digital Film Archive Project.
Yeah, Chris. You know, there's actually it's been about a year since we had Heather Juni on the show to talk about it. Both her and Chris Lee have been pretty heavily involved with creating this digital archive of film footage that has been taken over the, oh, I don't know, past, I guess, almost 50, 60, 70 years that have been, you know, basically collecting dust. So what they have successfully established is the conversion of a lot of those analog film resources into digital.
Well, during, you know, the days in which modern Hawaii history is being made, the statehood and those times, people were shooting 16-millimeter film all the time. This is what we're talking about, right?
Exactly,
the
right. And
news
and
camera
so a lot
archives.
Of that film is sitting in canisters, or if it's lucky to have some kind of a protection, or maybe it's just sitting in some shelf.
Yeah.
And you know, there's been recognized value in a lot of that footage for not only, you know, research and entertainment, but you know, it really kind of captures what has taken place in the past. And when you go to the site currently is up. It's called Uluulu, and it's at uluulu.hawaii.edu. They're currently, you know, in the process of archiving more of these film assets.
Well, it's enormously valuable because, you know, it's day-to-day history. And, you know, sometimes you can learn a lot from even the small stories that happened 50, 60 years ago, can't you?
That's true, absolutely. So we'll get to talk to Heather today on the show.
Terrific. Thanks a lot, Bert. That's Bite Marks Cafe at 5 p.m.
Not long ago in a backyard quiz, we asked you about the beginnings of the Hawaii fashion wave that seemed to come out of nowhere thanks to the creativity and vision of several designers in the late 60s and 70s, which made us wonder, could such a thing happen again? Apparently, the Hawaii Fashion Incubator and the State Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism were wondering the same thing. And more than just considering what if, the state is supporting an initiative to make Hawaii a fashion destination. Hi-Fi and DBET are now announcing the first ever Fashion Month happening next October. Hi-Fi's co-founder, Melissa May White, joins us this morning. Hi there.
Good morning.
How would you describe Hawaii fashion now?
It's really in a state of exciting emergence. As you know, as you mentioned, we really had a thriving manufacturing base, a community back in the 60s and 70s that formed a significant industry locally. And since about, you know, the early 2000s when the Fashion Guild dissolved, the industry has slowly been kind of reinventing itself and coming out. And at this point, we have a huge base of emerging talent Even compared to about 5 years ago, we've come out of our workrooms and come together to form a community where people are now reaching the international stage.
Hi-Fi has been around since 2007, and you say trying to create a new industry. Will there be certain drivers to this industry in the same way that we saw what happened in the 70s where, you know, there was something about a Malia print? I mean, you just knew what it was. But the color, the influence of botanicals, of life here in Hawaii that were on a very large scale, they weren't little, they weren't shy, and you had to feel really good about walking in and wearing them and carrying yourself well enough. And I could kill for some of the things that were in my mother's closet that are now gone. But those things now suddenly have cachet all over again. Does that mean that we're in for another wave of this, or are your designers really looking to do something different?
Well, many of those inspirations and themes that you mentioned are still really, and they still really exist and are still really relevant. You know, but then Hawaii itself has changed. So people that are doing design in Hawaii are drawing inspiration from so many different sources, notably, you know, the natural beauty of the Hawaiian Islands. That's always a constant kind of an inspiration. But, you know, the cultural influences that we experience here. So basically, you know, I don't know that Hawaii fashion is going to have as much of a singular face as it has in the past with aloha wear. And it's not really I don't want to be the one to arbit that. My job is to kind of sit back and see what all these creative talents bring to the table and to support them and to observe. And what I see is that the Hawaii brand is shining through in a way that is diverse, but also kind of highlights the uniqueness of Hawaii.
So trying to get to, if someone's listening to this thinking, well, you know, but what really somehow typifies Hawaii fashion in a way that's different from just good fashion that happens to be produced in Hawaii?
It's the influence of the place itself. You know, there's something, there's the culture, there's the land. It gives rise to an aesthetic that is a little bit more relaxed, something that people relate to, you know, I think it's notoriously hard to put into words, but that people around the world relate to. And that's what makes the brand of Hawaii so special and so alluring for so many people that visit and relate to that idea of Hawaii.
So for a Hawaii designer who has, let's say, made it big, and you and I are at Fashion Week a couple of years from now, would there be something that you could say, aha, see, there's Hawaii?
Sure. I think that, you know, aloha prints and the bold colors and the prints are something that will endure and evolve. And I think you can see that even in modern, in some of the new incarnations of established brands like Sig Zane and Iolani and, you know, and then newer brands like Manuhealii. And then there's brands like Mumu Heaven that are actually using old aloha prints but reinventing them in modern styles.
And modern shapes.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So the shape is starting to define it as well as the print.
Exactly. So, you know, today's fashion graduates from Hawaii's, you know, UH and HCC and other fashion programs, they're looking to the level of New York and Paris, but at the same time, they're grounded in the Hawaii inspiration in many cases. So,
on the continuum of cost, will these be very, very high-end pieces that you see that will really make it, or will it be more of a middle to upper end that will be more accessible to most people?
I think Hawaii has really strong potential to make an impact in the fashion market at almost every level. You know, swimwear, we've already made a really great niche. Our swimwear designers are in every Sports Illustrated annual swimwear issue, and even jewelry, we've had designers win international awards. So, you know, everyone thinks about swimwear and resort wear when they think about Hawaii, but I think we have solid talent at pretty much every level and at every aspect, including photography, modeling, you know. So we have a solid talent base. Yeah.
You want to pass on a couple of trends or tips as people are looking to put a little bit more of Hawaii-based fashion into their closets, perhaps?
Well, I would say start with buying local and exploring what's out there as far as the local design. Chinatown is starting to become a little bit of a hub for local designers and boutiques. Just walking around there, you can kind of get an idea what's out there. But, you know, one thing, I think Hawaii just personally for me, it makes me want to wear color and print and to accessorize boldly. So, and I don't think that ever goes out of style when the weather's this nice.
You just have to do it judiciously if you're not 5'11".
Right.
Melissa, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Melissa May White is the Hi-Fi co-founder, and she's loved fashion since childhood. A one-time designer and fashion writer, her current passion is bringing the community together around great style. Today, the Hawaii Fashion Incubator, a.k.a. Hi-Fi, and the state announced it will do the same next October for the first ever Fashion Month. More about it is on the website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Good morning. I'm Nadine Tansala. I'm from Hawaii Independent Physicians Association, and you're listening to The Conversation at HPR 2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
Today in the backyard, we asked you for the name of the Royal Hawaiian Band's first leader from 1871 to 1915. He is considered to be the most influential in the band's history. Before arriving in Hawaii, he learned his trade in the Prussian Army and was originally brought here on loan from Kaiser Wilhelm I to Kamehameha V. He became a Hawaiian citizen under King Kalakaua, tirelessly expanding the band's repertoire, arranging music, adapting Hawaiian songs, and writing some of his own. His best-known composition is the kingdom's national anthem, Hawaii Ponoi, now our state song, and his legacy influences us to this day. The band keeps a regular schedule of free public performances listed on its website, and its standard of musicianship remains high, thanks in part to the man who conducted more than 32,000 concerts during his 43 years behind the Royal Hawaiian Band baton, Kapellmeister Heinrich August Wilhelm Henry Berger. That's today's backyard quiz. If you've got one for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you're ever backstage at a big music festival and you're curious about just who put it together, just look for the person who looks completely exhausted. There's no end to the amount of work involved in bringing artists from all over to a Hawaii stage, but Ken Bergmeier is a veteran at this sort of thing. His latest round-the-clock obsession is the upcoming second annual Big Island Jazz and Blues Festival 2013, coming up Memorial Day weekend, and includes a handsome array of artists, and he's on the phone to tell us about it. And Ken, I don't envy you your job.
Oh, good morning, Chris. Well,
good morning.
Thanks for the support. Yeah, I don't blame you. It's a lot of work, I'll tell you. And some people just don't have any idea. But you know, it's a passion that you have to have, and a drive to, and a love for music and culture. You know, that kind of.
But it also has to involves a lot of patience with the behind the scenes work that it takes to bring, you know, an hour worth of performance on your stage. It has many hours by you behind it, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You know, days and days of planning. You know, months actually too. It leads on, but you know, you just gotta. You know, it starts out. You know, hey, there's a lot of key elements like the right location. Is there electrical, water, parking, internet? Mm-hmm. The infrastructure you need for an event can be overwhelming at times.
Was it pretty overwhelming, your first time out? I mean, this is not your first rodeo, but when you did your first couple of rodeos, was it pretty overwhelming?
You know, at some moments, it really seemed to be like, what am I doing?
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you get the right team behind you and, like I say, this drive to really pull off something incredible for families and people to have in their memories for a lifetime. Like, you know, just doing these festivals, that's a very stimulating and a drive that keeps us going.
Well, I would think, Ken, that one of the things you need to start out with is a certain amount of confidence that you're going to have an audience at the end of your rainbow, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, in this, being like a promoter in Hawaii and, you know, any festival, you're a gambler.
Yeah, okay? Sure.
And you got to roll the dice. But we do feel like, hey, if we bring in about 6, 7, 8 well-known musicians, artists who are respected, and make the events, you know, sometimes most of our events are free for starters, but we do have like the Big Island, we do chat charge, we try to keep the cost as low as possible. But, you know, like I say, it's a gambling process. You just got to go for it. And we've been blessed, you know, doing festivals for almost 2 decades here in Hawaii. So it's not our first rodeo, but I'll tell you what, every time we think, okay, we're going to do it again. Last year we did like 6 festivals. And this year we're on to do 6 again. And, you know, after you feel the success of it, and you're right, when you're looking for that guy, the most tired-looking guy in people, you nailed it right there in the beginning.
It's a sleep deprivation issue that I was kind of thinking about. You know?
I wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and said, oh, man, I forgot to do this.
Yeah, there has to be, right?
Oh, yeah, and I run to my computer and boom, boom, I have to bang it out.
Yeah, well, the whole time zone thing, right? You're dealing with people who are in New Orleans and all over the place
as
well.
Yeah, New York and, you know, those time structures, and then I'll get a phone call on my cell phone. Sometimes they just forget, oh, shoot, just 4 o'clock in the morning there. Oh, sorry, Ken. But you just get through it and you work. And we're just, you know, like I say, we're just blessed to be able to make these events really happen. And they're getting a huge following. I mean, with the internet the way it is and social media, it's incredible what kind of responses we get. You know, so much flowing aloha and support.
Has that helped a lot, the growth of things like Twitter and Facebook?
Absolutely.
Really given you a boost?
Doing stuff. Shoots, even 5, 6 years ago, we didn't have this.
Yeah.
It was more of a struggle. I still to this day go to businesses and hand a poster. I was just on the Big Island, and go to businesses independently and just knock on the door and say, hey, I'm Kenny, can we put these posters up? We're doing this.
That's the old way.
You still have to do that.
Yeah.
Okay, I hardly believe that, but you have to, you know, we're in that technological age where we have to do the Facebook and the Twitter and everything
but
else.
You're still wearing out shoe leather at the same time.
Absolutely. Wearing those slippers all down.
Wearing out rubber, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you at the end of the day, you know, I'm going out there. Like, I was on the Big Island. I drove 300 miles in one day.
Uh-huh.
Going Kona, Hilo, all the way back over.
Only on the Big Island can you do that.
Yeah, only on the Big Island. It's like being back on the mainland, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, you got to realize, oh, okay, man, I can barely talk this morning.
Well, you know, one of the things that you do with your festivals is you have a mix of mainland, you know, international and local artists.
Mm-hmm.
And do you find that when you get some, you know, people that we don't get to hear that much in Hawaii, Delphio Marsalis is coming out, right?
Yes.
As an example. And then you pair that with local talent, like you've got Volcano Choi playing. And does it help foster appreciation of who we've got here, homegrown artists?
Absolutely. There's those moments. We've had so many magical moments where, like, Delphio Marsalis or Joe Louis Walker, these are legends.
Yeah.
And Les McCann, and they'll bring up a local guy like Junior Volcano Choi or Paula Fuga or Brother Nolan or John Keave on stage, and they're playing together. And I've seen some, you know, friendships form and some even new CD projects where they're working together, which is really enlightening too.
Well, that's the thing that's sort of the difference between a festival and a more dry concert or club presentation, isn't it? That interaction.
And in our festivals, we always try and do them. They're like, you know, 2, 3, or 4 days.
Mm-hmm.
So the musicians really get to know each other, and a fan can come and hang out. It's not like we have the big backstage, the big security, you know, thing happening.
Yeah.
You can kind of mingle, and when a musician's done, we send them over to the CD, and you can talk story with them. They'll sign your CD, your autograph, get photos. Real true aloha flowing consistently, and that's That's my goal. I don't want to make this like, uh-oh, you know, you can't go past this line. Sorry, get out.
Don't touch me.
I've been to those festivals like,
oh yeah.
You know, it's we just try and make it. It's we're Hawaii, and I want to keep those kind of like back roots, you know, Hawaiian style, you know, kind of pila.
Do the musicians that you bring in, do they say this is different here? The feeling is different here.
Absolutely, and you know, most guys all come here. You know, a lot of festivals, they come in and they're maybe in one night and they're out of there. With our festival, all our musicians usually hang out for 4, 5, or 6 days.
They look for an excuse to add as many days as possible.
Yeah. Yes, and that's, you know, that's one, you know, way I get some of these great legends, Grammy winners coming over, like say, hey, I'll give you a little vacation too, and I'll take you to show you this here in Hawaii, and they get into it and they say, hey, you know, bring your wife, and they look at it as a little getaway for them. And it's a win-win for everybody.
Not a tough sell for you to get the artists to come.
No. It's like I say, we that's why we all live here, right? And it does. Maui, Hawaii, Big Island, you know, it has a draw.
Well, Ken, thanks very much for talking with us. It's great to catch up with you.
All right, Kristen, thanks, and love your show, and carry on with all you do for us.
Thanks, buddy.
Okay, aloha.
Kenneth Bergmeier is the director of the second annual Big Island Jazz and Blues Festival 2013. It's set for the weekend of May 30th, and details are on our HPR website.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the 8th Annual Hawaii Book and Music Festival, with more than 500 presenters and 150 events, May 18th and 19th on the grounds of Honolulu Hale. HawaiiBookAndMusicFestival.org.
Virtuoso guitarist Ian O'Sullivan has been described as thoughtful by Classical Guitar Magazine and delightful by the Honolulu Star Advertiser. In his Atherton debut, Ian played to a standing-room-only audience. This year, he's promising a combination of Bach and Paraguayan composer Augustin Barrios, as well as local composers Jeff Peterson, Bailey Matsuda, and Byron Yasui, when he performs in HBR's Atherton studio on Saturday, May 18th at 7:30. Reservations at 955-8821 during business hours.
Beth Ann, earlier you talked to Mayor Caldwell about the ongoing logjam over the Natatorium, a 40 years and counting problem, and I was reflecting on how many similar problems have been in a state of stagnation as long as I can remember, and I'm talking 30 years in Hawaii.
But the Natatorium seems to be a new definition for stagnation.
Yeah,
in many ways.
It's at the top of most lists.
Yeah, and eventually it will have an end, whether or not we make an impact as to which way it will go. It's crumbling, you know, and there will be a lot of issues that will happen if it simply is let to crumble too. The question is, can we be proactive about this now? Can we actually make a decision and say, this is what we're going to do with this and this is why? Or are we going to have the constant battling for decades and decades to come? It's, in some cases, it's enough already.
Looking back over the last few decades, it has seemed that the different sides in this issue are at the kind of loggerheads that sort of cancel each other's out.
Well, once upon a time, getting Nancy Bannock, rest her soul, in a conversation about this means you'd be in it for days.
Exactly.
That's going to do it for us for today. Up tomorrow. It's the end of the school year. We're going to check in with voluntarily homeless teacher and debt zapper David Gardner.
And visitors can take part in an archaeological dig on Kauai.
We have several options for you to be in touch. You can find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or at BecauseHPR. And if you still like email, well, we've got that too. Talkback at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org. And if you want to make sure you never miss a show, you can sign up for the podcast. I'm Chris Vandenberg.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.